You're listening to Radio New Zealand National, and this is Country Life. Pusima Afiaki was a policy analyst at the Ministry of Commerce in Wellington until 1992. But a visit to Tonga that year saw him decide to end his career as a bureaucrat and return home and farm. From a small start, he has built up Tinopai farms to export coconuts, yams, taro, fine mats, as well as cosmetics. Radio New Zealand's Pacific Issues correspondent, Richard Pamatutou, was given a tour of his traditional farm about 10 kilometres from Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa.
Sunday in Tonga is for family and church, and for Pusima Afiaki, the only time he has for a quiet walk around his traditional farm on customary land. As a birthright, every man in Tonga is entitled to 8 acres of land to grow crops, both to feed his family and to sell. At this farm, much of the work is around producing coconut oil, and there's also a small refrigeration unit where root stock for Japanese taro is stored.
They're graters which sit on their machine graters. You grate the coconut, then it gets weighed, then it goes onto it, that big metal surface there, that's a steel dryer. In there, there's a furnace up the front, so you burn the husk in the shell. That heats up the metal top. You dry the grated coconut, then it goes into a stainless steel pipe and gets pressed on there, and the oil comes out. So you've got 5 workers doing that when they're doing that.
I thought coconut oil was made by putting it outside in the sun.
We
was
used that the to, old? This is a new thing that was developed by a guy in Australia. But traditionally, how we made oil is you grate a coconut, you squeeze it into cream, then you rendered it, just slow boiling, boiling, boiling to render off the water, evaporate off the water, then you lift the oil. Right, long, slow, and you couldn't get all the water out, so it would always go rancid after a time, you know. But this process, it's amazingly quick. 1 hour from crack the coconut to press the oil, and very little, tiny amount of water in it, so it doesn't go off, it doesn't go rancid. Yes, it's the system we use, I think there are 50 or 60 of these little things around the Pacific, and the guy who invented it is actually a Kenyan. His parents ran a tea plantation in Kenya, and he ended up learning a lot about coconuts, immigrated to Australia, and developed this process. The only waste product is the water from the brown coconuts, but there's no toxic waste or anything. Yeah, it's very clean. You make a bit of smoke out here in the middle of the Pacific, it doesn't really matter, you know, and it's clean smoke, it's just coconut husk smoke.
Where do you get the coconuts from?
We buy them in, because that's actually our bread and butter. That's what we export into New Zealand and Australia. That's what we make our money on to, you know, be able to get into oil and other bits and pieces.
You don't grow them yourselves, though?
No, we have some coconuts, but not enough to supply what we need for export purposes. So we buy here, buy nationally. Right? Yeah, that's our game. I grew up here as a boy. We lived here in the 60s and then the 70s.
So where was your family home?
It was just on that mound there. And in fact, if you look behind the bananas there, there's a little hut there. That's a toilet shower hooked up to the old septic tank. So the pipes are still running. We have a well that was hand-dug, 67, I think, by uncles of mine. And at one stage, we actually had 7 houses here. So that's the base left of one house. There was one house up on the mound, one there. Two here, of which this old little thing in the corner there, that was our boy's hut. We had a lot of people living out here, between 30 and 40 people. Eh? We went to school in Nuku'alofa, so lots of memories out here. And it ended up when we came back, there was no house here, so we were living in town at the family home there. And we're on the 4th 5-year plan to build a house here. The views are beautiful. The whole lagoon is whangauta, and we're looking over there. You can see Kauwai, which is the King's Estate. When we walk along a bit further there, you'll be able to get a better view. If you go up about 10 foot, you've got smashing views over the lagoon. You might have seen just along the road there when we came. And you've got breeze coming off the lagoon, even in the hot time. It's a lovely place to live.
Not too many mosquitoes.
They're mozzies, but you just get used to that. They eat you and you don't know it. You know, what did the Hindus say? You've got to share all things of God's.
But not all the plants are traditional.
What are we doing on our home farm here?
This is coffee, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We're farming. We've got a 30-acre block that we're farming on the King's Estate, just near where his home is, the palace, or the villa. That's quite intensive farming up there, technical and commercial. It's a 30-acre flat block, like the airport, no trees. So we've got irrigation and bores, and when you farm that kind of farming, a lot of time and effort, we didn't have a lot of time left for our home farm, so we decided to turn it into an extensive farming, you know, so tree farming. Much less work, right, to look after it, to give us, because we haven't got that much time left. But at the same time, it's beautiful, you know. Orchards, tree farms are pretty. So these coffees, I think they're 4 years old now. They'll grow to just over 6 foot, a bit taller than this, about up to seven probably. So they've got another couple of years, they'll hit that. And then you've just got, you know, rows of coffee here and here. We planted coffee because that was the planting material. We're a bit limited for planting material here in Tonga. When we wanted to start planting, you know, tree things, coffee was what was available in bulk. So we got 1,100 coffees and planted them. That's what's here. In terms of making money, it's not a money-making thing. We make money out of coconuts and oil and other stuff. This is a pure lifestyle thing. So in another 5 years, it'll be all 7 foot and you wander between it. We plant it wide so you can plant things in between it or just wander. Right? So we're getting close to the stage, we'll just mow it like this. And just have, you know, full-time worker here mowing. He starts at this end, mows all the way down to the end of the farm and comes back here and mows again, you know.
Why didn't you plant citrus?
We could. Again, it was just a bulk thing. We wanted to plant half-acre, one-acre blocks, and it's just not that kind of planting material around, or stuff like that. What I found was coffee, and then our next block is vanilla. Now I'm searching around for what to plant in bulk. You know, it's not easy to find 1,000 seedlings of anything. So when you say citrus, yeah, I've got very happy to plant 1,000 oranges or lemons, but I can't find it anywhere, seedlings. Yeah, if you go overseas, it gets tricky with importing stuff. And yeah, but I'm saying here in Tonga, our nursery, they don't produce that kind of stuff. So the constraints is that.
There's a substantial planting of vanilla bean vines, destined for export, plus trees for traditional weaving.
Vanilla beans?
Hmm.
Yeah, these are maturing, ripening. Hmm? Those are the leaves. It's a funny plant, vanilla. It's called an epiphyte. Epiphytes grow on other plants, but for support. So you can see the vanilla thing is kind of wobbly, so it can't grow by itself on the ground. It needs something to grow.
So what's it growing on?
A tree called a fiki, which is not a fig like in the Bible. And it just works out to be a very easy tree to grow them on. Yeah, they live together easily. You let it grow up this height and you just cut that off. You don't want the vanilla growing too high, then you can't hand pollinate.
What I'm seeing here is that a lot of these things are handcrafted products in a way, aren't they? The vanilla bean,
sure.
It's a boutique agricultural product.
From Tonga, yeah, definitely. And a lot of effort, you know, to do it. That's why you pay for real vanilla as opposed to the imitation. You look after these plants, you pick it once a year, and then you dry it. And long, tedious, hard work. And even this, it looks ragged, but this is deliberate. You have to have a canopy. Hey,
Matamau.
Hey. Okay, whatever. You have to have a canopy about this deep around the vanilla to keep it moist around the roots. Vanilla doesn't like dry. Right? So this looks untended, but it's not. It's carefully tended to be this long. What we do is we pull out the big weeds. This particular grass only grows this high. Right? The bigger weeds we take out, right, and then leave this. And over a period now of 3 years, we've got down to this kind of canopy. But you can't mow like this. Yeah.
These are pandanus here, aren't they?
Yeah. And the pile you saw back there in the shed, it's just been cut off this last week. We have three different pandanus varieties growing on the farm. We have this leaf, which is very long and produces a dark brown, when it's dry, produces a dark brown leaf for weaving. And so it makes dark brown mats and thick. Then we have another variety, which is thin and white. And then we have a coarse one, which is they make like floor mats out of. Right?
So those on the other side, they're more pandanus or?
Yes, those big, huge, bushy ones, that's the coarse one. There are at least seven varieties of lower cow pandanus in Tonga that I've heard of. The dark brown one and the white one, they're the most expensive ones when it comes to processing for sale. Then we've also got the cheapest one, which is that one for making floor mats. That's for bulk.
Do you have to do anything to the pandanus to get them to produce, or do you just...
You plant them and then they go. Yeah.
You don't have to fertilise or anything?
No. Our soil is pretty amazing. It's a similar type of soil of volcanic loams to what you have around Auckland, right? So
it looks like Pukekohe.
Pukekohe, I mean, it's a volcanic loam. It's beautiful, and we have no rock in it. And our soil here on this farm, it's actually thin, our topsoil. Where we live in Dufour, it's 6 foot deep topsoil here, 3 foot up at that end of the farm, and then drops down to about a foot. But, you know,
and what's beneath it then?
A rock. Oh, you've got a clay layer, and then you've got the limestone rock, which was the old reef, you know, that Tonga was once upon a time before it got pushed up. That's what I was going to say. It was hiapo. We've got hiapo growing in between, right along the bank there, and it grows up to 12 foot, and when it gets to the size of about a 50 cent piece, the diameter, and so you just cut it down the bottom, you strip the bark off, and that's what then gets beaten into strips and then put together to make those huge long tapa cloth.
And the art of tapa and growing the mulberry, that's not dying at all, is it?
Not here in Tonga. Our cultural thing, you have to have ngatu for funerals, weddings, birthdays, and other stuff won't do. So you have to have mats, and you have to have ngatu, and you have to have pigs. For instance, a cow will not do instead of a pig. You must have a pig. Synthetic mat will not do in place of a real mat. When you ask, is there a likelihood that the skills will be lost? I don't think so. There is transition in there. You're using synthetic materials to weave waste mats. And similarly, there is tapa cloth now made which has a synthetic backing. You know the thin curtains that people use on their
yeah? Yeah, like net.
Yeah, like net, right? Like mosquito netting. So they use that as a backing. Then you put real ngatu on top of that. So that saves you half the ngatu. But when it comes to formal gift giving, it's not sufficient, right? That would not be accepted. It would be regarded as very rude for somebody to give that, depending on the circumstances. Where a lot of that goes is overseas Tongans who can't afford to be so choosy, right? So it's made here and exported.
The other produce, stored in the farm's noisy cooler, is taro rootstock, planted later in the year for export to Japan.
They look like our big taro, but they're small and they've got tiny corms. The Japanese, the number one size they like is ping pong ball. Quite different, yeah, from our...
And you export the taro to the Japanese?
Yes. Yeah, we've been working on this since 2001, so we're in our 8th year this year, and our 5th year of exports. Yeah.
And that's a premium product then, isn't it?
Yeah, it is in Japan. We haven't been able to develop the volume demand yet. Well, we're still working on it. We're hoping in the next couple of years it'll come off. Like all farming projects, it takes a long time.
Would Tongans buy a little taro or not? It's not right for them
to eat? Well, if you're a Tongan family and there are like 10 of you at home and you've got to peel taro for your 10 people to eat, which would you prefer? Two big ones or 100 of those? The taste is the same and the texture is a little bit different. It's actually even, it's like custard, really smooth. But look at the work.
Is that a native?
It's not here. We brought the planting material originally from Japan. But apparently, genetically, you know, the DNA analysis, it's the same taro that we grow in Tonga. Over tens of thousands of years of ours growing in different places that developed differently. Same DNA base, but over years and years and years, you know, turned into different, sort of like you get red skin potatoes and white skin, etc. I mean, it's all potatoes, but that's what's happened with this apparently. I'm not sure whether it works out that the taro was all small like that and became bigger, or it was big and became small. I mean, I think we got the better end of the deal with our taro here in the Pacific. I'd far rather have one big thing and peel that than do that.
In terms of exporting your products to New Zealand, how does that go for you guys?
Getting harder and harder. The whole non-tariff barrier thing over time is just ratcheting up. That's both quarantine and food health issues, right? So to give you a couple of examples, the honey bee mite thing.
Varroa mite.
That led to a ban on all mites coming into New Zealand, whether they had anything to do with bees or not. So for the last 5 years since that varroa mite thing happened in New Zealand, all mites have been banned, even ones that had nothing to do with that. And so our coconuts, of course, have mites, our taro has mites, you know, coming from the Tonga and other places in the Pacific. It's all been fumigated for the last 5 years. For taro, they've just sorted that out, and mites are no longer an issue for taro. But coconuts, they're still sorting that out. 5 years ago, if they found mites on coconuts, no big deal. It didn't live in New Zealand, right? It didn't survive and didn't affect anything. For the last 5 years, you know, massive expense and time and poison, you know, put into our coconuts and our taro and all those sort of things from the Pacific for no reason. Now, that's got a happy ending, that one, but it took 5 years. The next example is cassava. Cassava, apparently, like many foods, got natural levels of hydrocyanide. Normally not a problem. Some varieties have it quite high, so that can be a problem. You've got to soak it and then eat it, right, to let the cyanide come out. We don't have those bitter varieties in Tonga, right? So we just eat our cassava straight and our pigs eat it. But New Zealand and Australia, we found this out just 3 weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, the Food Standards Association New Zealand and Australia have got a new sort of like a proposal. They're going to reduce the minimum levels of cyanide allowable in cassava chips and things like that coming out of the Pacific from 25, whatever it is they measure, down to 10. Now, we in the Pacific, we're arguing, why are you dropping this like this from 25 to 10? If 25 is okay for the rest of the world and WHO and whatnot, we'll see what comes out of that. But there's yet another example of these non-tariff barriers coming in. The bad thing about that is when there's no justification for that barrier. The mites thing was an overreaction, as it turns out. Knocked for 5 years on that. We're still knocked with coconuts, but we'll see how that works out over the next little while. The cassava thing, if they drop it to 10, there could be a whole lot of aspiring cassava chips people just got going in the Pacific, suddenly bang, out of business. You know, the list goes on and on. It's not just New Zealand. Australia plays the game, and you know, it's just ever increasing overseas now. The unfortunate thing for us in the Pacific, because we're so small, those sort of decisions can wipe us out and just kill an industry. Whereas, you know, other countries, okay, there's something else that they can switch into. We don't have that much choice in exports here.
Pusima Afiaki ending that report.